It's Thursday, April 1st. Saskatchewan Senator David Tkachuk says the letter the University of Ottawa provost sent to the right-wing pundit Ann Coulter could have come, quote, straight out of the re-education camps of Pol Pot's Cambodia. Currently, and on behalf of all Canadians, thank you, David Tkachuk, for keeping hyperbole in check. This is The Current Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Current. I'm Lyndon McIntyre, sitting in for Anna Maria Tremonti. For years, David Frum has been a powerful figure in American conservative politics. He was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush, the one who famously or infamously helped coin the phrase "axes of evil." He was a senior foreign policy advisor to Rudy Giuliani during his run for the Republican presidential nomination. And he was a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, one of the most influential conservative think tanks in the United States. The British newspaper, The Guardian, called David Frum one of the 50 most influential conservatives in America. But in the last 2 years, Frum has been at odds with the Republican Party's leadership, especially the extremist wing represented by commentators like Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and Ann Coulter. He alienated the right-wing Mandarins even further last month when he wrote that the passing of the new U.S. health care bill was the Republican Party's Waterloo. On the heels of that column and some stinging criticism from the Wall Street Journal, David Frum announced that he was leaving the American Enterprise Institute, and now the circumstances under which he left have become a hotly debated topic among American conservatives. David Frum joins us this morning from Washington. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning.
We'll get to the big political issues in a minute, but first the age-old question, did you jump or were you pushed?
Oh, I'm not bashful about this. I was jumped. I was pushed, rather. What happened was I had been at AEI since 2003. I've done a lot of work over that time. Day that the Wall Street Journal ran its editorial about me, the president of AEI invited me out to lunch. We met a few days later, and he said, in effect, that while I was certainly welcome to continue at the Institute, that they would we would want to take our relationship to the next level, and that would be a level where they would take away my office, my salary, and and my health care coverage.
That's not a promotion, David.
I thought, under those circumstances, you can have my resignation. I am not hot about this. I think think tanks are remarkable places. They are places. It's a great privilege to be given a room in which you can think and write as seems right to you. And no one has any obligation to continue that with anybody whose work they don't like.
But usually there has to be cause. Why did they do it?
Well, first, of course, there has to be cause. I mean, not in any legal sense, but they have to have a motive. I think the timeline speaks for itself. I published my now notorious Waterloo article last Sunday. The Wall Street Journal had a lead editorial slamming me by name on Monday morning. That doesn't happen very often. The Journal's an important voice in the conservative world. I get my invitation to meet a couple of hours later, and 3 days after that, I'm out the door.
Now, there's talk. You've been writing a lot and talking a lot about health care. How divergent were your opinions on Obama's health care package from the consensus among American Enterprise management and financial donors?
Well, look, here's the crazy part about all of this, and the ominous part, and the part that is about something more interesting than me. I would have voted no on the Obama health plan had I been a member of Congress. It raises taxes too much. It regulates too much. And one important part of the program expands dramatically, the program called Medicaid. That is the program that provides health insurance for the poor, which shares costs among the federal government and the states in a way that is very dysfunctional, that causes tremendous cost inflation while running a very bad program. So I would have voted no on those grounds. Where I dissented was this. The American right, really from a couple of weeks before the 2008 election, has been working itself into a lather about President Obama, seeing him as more than just a liberal president with a very big mandate, who's very ambitious and who's very savvy, and where it will take a lot of cool, calm, and self-possession to oppose him effectively, that they have, maybe because of the extreme economic circumstances, worked themselves into this idea. We're living almost in the last days of constitutional government in the United States, that you cannot, and that there is just no dealing with this person at all. He is not to be trusted. You can't work with him. There's no possibility of compromise. I don't think that's right, and especially not right on health care, because the core of the plan that emerged from the Senate especially was based on Republican ideas. What Obama is trying to do nationally is very similar to what Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts in 2005. That, in turn, depends very heavily on ideas that the Republicans in Congress advanced in 1993 and 94 as the Republican alternative to what Bill Clinton wanted to do. And that, just to follow the family tree a little farther, all comes from ideas developed at the Heritage Foundation, a very conservative think tank, in 1989, 1990. So while there are specific elements of Obamacare that people believe in limited government and free enterprise need to be concerned about, the basic mechanics are acceptable. In fact, there are ideas.
So they shouldn't have had any quibble with anything you've said about health care.
Well, no, there are reasons to quibble, because what had happened, I think that the reason the article was the Waterloo article was provocative to American conservatives for two reasons. The first was, as I say, it rested on the assumption that there was a deal to be done. If Obama is Hitler, if he's trying to murder your grandmother, obviously you can't deal with people like that. So the article contained a repudiation of, I think, the way that talk radio and Fox News, not the way most American Republicans who are level-headed people think, but the way the most hot-headed voices think. But second, Republicans in Congress had bet heavily that they could inflict a stinging defeat on the president. The phrase Waterloo, the title of my article, comes from Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, who had said in 2009 that if the Republicans could stop Obama's health care plan, it would be his Waterloo, the destruction of his presidency. So they bet everything on outright opposition. And my article said, now we need accountability, because what this means is we missed the chance to shape the bill. So we got a much more left-wing bill than we could have had if we'd bargained, and there was a bargain to be done. We abandoned the chance to shape the bill in hope of gaining a political win. In fact, we have a political loss and an unshaped bill. This is a disaster, and there has to be an accounting of the people who led us to this disaster.
Now, the Institute is basically boiled down, and they wouldn't come on the radio to talk about this. And we thank you for coming on, but they're basically saying that they fired you because you weren't coming to the office often enough. You weren't working hard enough. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I just said, if you believe that, you'll believe anything. In the age of Google, it's very easy to check what people have done. Since 2003, I've written three books. I've written more than 1,000 newspaper and magazine articles. I've done more TV and radio appearances that I can count. I've lectured in, I think, I don't know, half a dozen different countries. Lest we forget, we had a tremendous battle in 2005 over the shape of the Supreme Court. President Bush advanced nominee named Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court, and I was one of the few people who actually was personally acquainted with her, and although I liked her as a human being, I thought she'd be a bad nominee, and I organized the movement that stopped her and opened the way for Samuel Alito. So I think that's a fairly significant contribution to the shaping of American politics. That's what think tanks do. We generate ideas and we write about them.
The people that are saying these things, David, Arthur Brooks, Charles Murray.
Arthur Brooks, I think, and Charles Murray are different cats.
But they're friends of yours, right? So
yeah.
There's a certain amount of political fallout here. How are you affected by that?
Look, this American politics is a very tough game, and you shouldn't play in it if you're easily hurt.
Well, I'm just trying to look at what Murray said. David likes nothing more than being the center of attention, and I don't want to do anything to gratify him. That was his reaction to our request for some kind of a comment. I mean, how do you react when an old friend of yours comes out with something like that in public?
Well, I think I'll just say I'm not easily wounded. And I think we're playing for some very important issues here. And what we're debating is, in my mind, what we're debating is whether American conservatism is going to be a philosophy of government or whether it's going to be an industry of cultural dissent. Because one of my big themes here is that one of the reasons that conservatives got backed into this untenable position is that we have generated this talk radio and talk TV industry that flourishes most when there is the most confrontation, most alienation, and most anger. And the problem is you can't build a movement of government on that. And that's a lesson that Canadian conservatives have painfully learned and that British conservatives have painfully learned. I would wish American conservatives could learn less painfully. I, I'm very mindful here of the great line of Warren Buffett's that while it's good to learn from experience, it's better to learn from other people's experience.
And Democrats are now applauding you. We're going to run a little bit of tape here in a second. I mean, one of the Democrats in Congress, Jim McDermott, used your Waterloo column as a kind of to encourage the troops. Here's what he had to say.
As the dust settles, Mr. Speaker, on the Capitol today, I read an article called Waterloo by President George W. Bush speechwriter David Frum. I think it sums up nicely what we just witnessed. He began, "Conservatives and Republicans today suffered their most crushing legislative defeat since the 1960s. It's hard to exaggerate the magnitude of the disaster."
So here you have the Democrats have already begun to package you and your words as part of what they're hoping will become the Republican Waterloo. And where does that leave you?
Well, there's a phenomenon in the United States that conservatives joke about, where a newspaper article will appear about somebody and they will say, "Once regarded as a right-wing provocateur, Mr. X is now viewed with strange new respect." And strange new respect is an ironic, bitter joke among American conservatives. As that quote that Jim McDermott read indicated, I regard the passage of this bill as a disaster. I am not a liberal. I am not somebody on the left. I am not moving in a liberal direction. But what I want is a conservatism that is more responsible, more prudent, and more focused on government. And I also want a conservatism that is mindful of real-world politics. It really is a real-world problem that American health care costs are shooting up at the rate that they are, that America is now paying about 17% of its economy for health care. Canada spends about 10. No other developed country spends more than 11. And that is 6 points of GDP. This is an abstract way to thought. It's like if America spent as much of its income on health care as Switzerland, which is the runner-up, it would be like getting the entire U.S. defense budget for free with another few hundred billion dollars to spend on tax cuts.
We look at the conservative landscape in the United States now, and we see Sarah Palin dashing around the country, and we hear Beck, Limbaugh, we hear Ann Coulter. I mean, where are these moderate, policy voices that you're hoping will emerge in time to save the credibility of that party?
Well, they're quiescent right now. It's not that there's any lack of these people. Mostly they're in state governments, but governors like Mitch Daniels in Indiana, former governors like, I guess, Tim Pawlenty is still a governor of Minnesota, and who's running, he will be running for president, looks pretty clear. Mitt Romney, who will be running for president, almost certainly. Some of the California Republicans. But there's not a lack of leadership. There is a lack of followership, that these people know that unless they strike certain very strong notes, they will not be acceptable in the world of talk and Fox. That will cut them off from potential support. So this entertainment industry we've built transforms people who could be real-world leaders, actual representatives, into people who say things that they don't think, who take positions they don't believe in, and that make them unelectable, and if by some chance they're elected, make it impossible to govern.
But you have a terribly confused electorate. You have an electorate that doesn't know whether they believe that Sarah Palin is a clown or Sarah Palin is the second coming. They don't know whether Rush Limbaugh is the voice of American tradition or a nutcase making money on the radio. How do you straighten that out?
The public is not confused about this, and this is one of the things that happens when you live inside an enclave. Sarah Palin is, by any way you can measure, one of the most unpopular people in American political life. Now, it is impossible to get conservatives to accept that because they know, well, there are a lot of people who like her. But it's a big country. There are a lot of people who like pickled herring. You have to do these things in percentage terms. And in percentage terms, she is one of the most unpopular and divisive figures in American life. The same thing is true with Rush Limbaugh. When the Obama administration decided to attack Rush Limbaugh, make him the symbol of the Republican Party in 2009, did they do it because they couldn't count, because they couldn't afford pollsters, because they were dumb? They knew exactly what they were doing. And when Republicans cooperate and say, "We'll agree with you in making a figure who is disliked by 90% of Americans under 30. We'll agree with you in making the face of our party," you're falling into a trap. And the same thing with Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin may be, I mean, this rule of political science, the vice presidential nominations don't matter. And all the talk we do is just to fill air at convention time when there isn't enough to say. Sarah Palin seems to have been the one vice presidential nominee since Lyndon Johnson to affect the ticket, and every way you can measure it, she hurt it. In the month of October 2008, she recorded the steepest decline in approval rating among women ever recorded by any major candidate. And today, when you ask, is she qualified to be president, 50% of registered Republican women say no.
For a little comic relief, and in that vein, we had Ann Coulter up here. You should have been here last week. And somebody actually asked her about you. Here's what Ann had to say.
There isn't much of a split. And by the way, you can take David Frum back, but it's David Frum versus everyone else.
I guess I have to ask if this hoo-hurrah is bringing out the inner Canadian in David Frum.
Well, look, I think it reflects some very painful Canadian experience. I was there for the 1993 split between conservatives and reformers that destroyed the conservative governing coalition and opened the way to 12 years in the wilderness for Canadian conservatives. And I had a chance to witness what Canadian conservatives had to do to make themselves an effective party of government again. I spent a lot of time in the UK. I have many friends involved in British conservative politics, and I can see what they've gone through. Now, America is different. It's a different kind of country, and it's a different kind of political system. But the changes that have happened in all of these countries, the most important demographic change we have seen since the 1980s is that we have had a huge increase in the proportion of the population that's gone to college, finished university. As recently as 1990, only about a fifth of American whites, and whites are who vote for the Republican Party, had finished university. Today, nearly one-third have. And those graduates, and especially women, have a very different approach to politics than their somewhat less educated parents and grandparents did a generation and two generations ago. It demands a new kind of politics. And when you have, we had a week, I guess it was last February, to February 2009, where in the same week, we had President Obama advance a Supreme Court nominee named Sonia Sotomayor, whom I opposed. But we were explaining that the reason she was bad was because President Obama had praised her empathy. And we were saying, empathy is not a qualification in the Supreme Court justice. That same week, Rush Limbaugh gave a major speech at a conservative event in which he denounced conservatives for listening too much to other people and especially their children. Now, when you have a problem with women voters, say, we are the party that doesn't believe in empathy and doesn't believe in listening. I understand women. I've been married for a while. Women, I can tell you firsthand, women don't appreciate that.
I guess with all these demographic changes and this political turmoil, David Frum may very well now fit better in the right wing of the Democratic Party than in the moderate section of what's left of it in the Republican Party.
No way. No.
You're still a Republican.
What is happening here? Look, the people who want to drive the car over the cliff may insist that they are the truest and most appropriate drivers of the car, and that the people in the back seat saying, I'd make a turn here if I were you, are traitors, weaklings, car passengers in name only, or whatever acronym they want to give. But I believe in limited government. I believe in the free enterprise system. I believe in a strong American defense. I believe in America as a hegemon within the world order. I believe in all of these conservative things. But I also believe that a party has to represent the country as it is, not as it used to be or as it was in some fantasy, that it cannot be socially reactionary, and that it cannot disregard the everyday practical economic concerns of most of its people.
Let me butt in for 1 second because we're running out of time. I want to get your estimate. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, Obama's presidency seemed to be over with the midterms coming up. Where is it now?
Obama's going to take a big hit in the midterms, and the American economy is under great strain. People are suffering. They will vote against the party in power. But he's got the business cycle behind him. He's got tremendous political gifts, and he's got opponents who seem determined to make obvious unnecessary mistakes.
You're on the Colbert Report tonight, or the Colbert Report tonight. Maybe you're going to get a job in that department.
I don't know. I'm going to stick to politics. Comedy is not something for which I feel I have a great gift.
Well, it's great talking to you, David, and we'll be watching your future because it seems to be lined up with history all of a sudden. Your mother would be proud. I've been talking to...
I think about her all the time. All of this happened, by the way, on the anniversary of her death, March 26, 1992.
Wow. Well, David, thanks for talking to us. David Frum is a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, and he was in our Washington studio. Well, that's it for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, 9 o'clock in Newfoundland and Labrador, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, send us your comments. Visit our website at cbc.ca/thecurrent and click on Contact Us, or you can call our feedback line toll-free at 1-877-287-7366. You can also find us on Twitter at TheCurrentCBC. And as always, our mailing address is P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Thanks for listening to The Current podcast. I'm Lyndon McIntyre.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.